This is Courage to Resist, bringing you the voices of the troops who refused to fight. William Shearer joined the U.S. Army at the age of 17. After basic training, infantry, and airborne training, he was deployed to Iraq. While there, Shearer began to have some serious personal problems, and he found that the Army was very unresponsive and unsupportive to his problems, and he began to develop concerns about the way the Army treats its soldiers. When he returned to the States, Shearer was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. He received no meaningful treatment for his PTSD, and at some point he decided he was going to find a way to get out. He is speaking to us today from his home in Florida. William, thanks for talking with Courage to Resist.
You're welcome.
Let's start by talking about when and why you went into the Army in the first place. You enlisted in what year?
2002. I was 17. So I just grew up being taught that that's, you know, being patriotic and taking care of my country. That's all I ever wanted to do.
And you went to basic training where?
Fort Benning, Georgia. I was in the infantry.
And after basic, you went to AIT, is that right?
Yeah, that was actually part of basic training. I went from basic training to AIT. Infantry is all the way through. It's 15 weeks, and then I went to airborne school after that.
So you were at Fort Benning for basic training and AIT, and after AIT, you went to airborne training?
Yes, sir.
And what unit were you in?
I was with the 1st Battalion, 509th Airborne Infantry. They're Op 4, actually. They weren't actually a deployable unit when the war started. They were pretty much teaching units what they needed to know before they went over to a combat area. We pretty much put them through a month-long simulation of combat.
But even though you were in a supposedly non-deployable unit, you deployed, didn't you?
I did deploy. I deployed for with the battalion, that battalion, actually, in 2004. Two of our companies deployed and were attached to the 10th Mountain, 431, over there, actually.
Deployed to Iraq?
Yes, sir.
Did you see much action in Iraq? What was it like for you?
You know, it was more of like, there wasn't a lot of action. It was more of, it's hard to explain down there. Like, action over there is like getting IED'd or maybe getting shot at a few times, you know, or a car bomb goes off. Action, you know, it's not exactly what you're expecting when you think of action a lot of times. It's more like a hunting season. You're the deer.
Did you have any friends who were hurt or killed?
Yeah, actually, I had Sergeant Brett Swank, one of my good friends. He was with Alpha Company. IED went off and ended up killing him. They were dismounted, I guess, and lost him. And then also we lost Sergeant Brown. We were very fortunate. Our company, actually, we didn't have any casualties as far as KIA in our company, but the unit we were attached to lost about 6 or 7 while we were there.
And how about you? Did you get injured?
No, I wasn't injured or anything. It was more of just getting knocked around a lot, IEDs, and you just get scuffed up from regular day-to-day, you know, running around and stuff like that.
How was morale in your unit?
It started out pretty good, actually, and as time went on, they don't tell. The longer you go, the less you learn. The less they tell you, you know. There really was no information for our soldiers. Everything was by word of mouth or like hearsay, you know. It's all rumors.
And you started to develop some negative feelings about the Army and about what was going on over there while you were in Iraq. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yes. While I was over there, actually, I was married right before I went. And, the Army was good. It was fine, you know. But when it comes down to doing the job, like what happened to me, everything that you care about, everything that means anything to you, goes right out the door. It means nothing anymore to you because that's not what your job is at that time, you know. And if something does happen in your life or that's important to you while you're over there, you can't do anything about it. And the Army is not going to go out of their way to make sure you're taken care of, you know. And in my case, I lost a lot while I was over there. And it just started, the more you lose and the less they do for you, the more you start to see how jacked up things really are.
Tell me more specifics. You said you were married right before you went over there. Were there marital difficulties that you had to deal with long distance while you were there?
Actually, yes. I was, when we got married, in January. And right after that, I got word that we were getting deployed. so I was in HHC. I wasn't even in the companies that was deploying. And something had happened in the two companies that was deploying, so they picked me up as a plug and put me into first platoon. And I had just gotten married. I had 2 weeks to get all my, like, all the shots and everything. Didn't even get everything I was supposed to get. The training, I missed out on a lot of training. Like, they had ample amount of time to prepare, you know. I didn't have so much time. And finally, next thing you know, I deployed 2 weeks later, and we were, me and my wife, we were just into our marriage, and we were having little issues already, you know. And while I was gone, it just got worse and worse and worse. She was starting adultery with an MP on post, you know. And the whole time, my platoon sergeant's wife, who lived across the street from me, was giving my platoon sergeant information about what was going on at my house. And every day he would tell me something else, you know. And he knew about what was going on, but nothing was done. Nobody, you know, this is another soldier who's sitting back on the stateside, not even, you know, doesn't care about the soldier who's overseas, let alone the wife, who, you know. And the Army did nothing, and there's plenty they could do, you know. And they did nothing. I lost a lot of money. I lost my family while I was there, you know, pretty much. And when I got back, it's just, I'd lost so much, it was like I needed to start over.
So let me get this straight. While you were over there, your old platoon sergeant, who was still stateside, was somehow informing you about your wife's carrying on with another man?
Yeah. It started to become like more of a joke to them. But the more of a joke it became to them, the more it infuriated me, you know? And it was just, it was nothing. They did nothing for me. And I couldn't do anything myself.
It sounds like they were mocking you about your marital difficulties.
Yeah, pretty much.
And there was no way you could get an emergency leave and come back home because they didn't really care about your problems, is that right?
As an infantryman, there is no emergency leave unless it's like a death in the family, you know, especially when you're in a combat zone. Like I said, everything that means something to you is right out the window. That doesn't mean anything to the military, you know, they don't care.
So there you were, and not only were you having to go into combat situations and put yourself in physical danger, you were also having to wrestle with all these personal problems, and you were getting absolutely no support.
Right, precisely, exactly. And, you know, at the time I was, what, 19, 20 years old, you know, I'd already made a huge transformation as far as being a kid to making a huge jump into doing what a man should be doing, you know, and it's just a whole lot that I was piling onto my shoulders, and you can only take so much, and especially in a situation like that.
Did you get any support from your fellow soldiers?
There are some, yeah, I could sit and talk to. Pretty much, though, they were just, you know, all that they could really tell you is, you know, hey, you need to focus on the task at hand, because, and they're right, it starts to put everybody else's lives in danger, you know? And so that's pretty much the support I was getting, besides the typical other soldiers who were going through about the same thing I was going through. It was more of like a comparing on what's going on, you know?
How long did you stay in Iraq?
We were there for 10 months, I believe.
And what happened when you came back?
We flew back from Kuwait, because you'd go from Iraq to Kuwait, and arrived back here, and we had our little return home ceremony, and my wife wasn't there, but then as things got back to normal, like 2 days later, we were starting cleaning weapons and stuff, and I got served divorce papers. The liaison to the post came up and served me divorce papers. I didn't even know that was going to happen, but it did.
And how about your relationship with the Army then? What was happening with that?
Actually, it started to diminish. The more things that would pile up on me, you know, I'd lost some family while I got, as soon as I got home too, and the more things that pile up, it just started, you know, it would start to deteriorate me as a soldier. It would make me look worse and worse, and it would get harder and harder, and the less they would start, you know, they didn't care. That's what I'm trying to get across, is they don't care. And if they don't care and nobody's helping you out, you start to not care, you know. You start you just look at everything that's bad. You have no positive whatsoever coming in. And so me and the military is pretty much diminishing quick.
So you're saying that not only didn't you get support while you were in a combat zone, you didn't get any support when you were back home either?
No, not really. I mean, I was checked out for PTSD. I got, when I got home, they put you through all these tests. You talked to a bunch of doctors. I was diagnosed with PTSD, depression, and a couple like sleep disorders and other things, and pretty much all they did was just start throwing me pills, kind of like to shut me up, you know, put me in like a I don't care vegetative state, pretty much just to have me there.
Sounds like basically their response was to give you medication, but not to give you counseling or any support in any other way, is that right? Just throwing pills at you?
Right. As far as me, there's no support. It was pretty, I mean, the counseling, they gave me counseling, but it wasn't for what was going on back home. It was for PTSD, and that was just unbelievable. I can't even classify it as counseling. Just talking, I was talking to some, she must have been in like her 60s, and she was like a retired colonel, I believe, but, you know, she's sitting there, and I would tell her some situations that I was in over there, and she would be like, oh, I understand, and I'm just like, how can you possibly understand, you know? Granted, you were in the military, but I guarantee you, you were not in any situation like this, and she kind of, it kind of makes you feel like you're whining almost, you know, the way they talk to you, and it's like, you just, when that starts happening, you're just like, whatever, and throw that right out the door. You don't even hang with what they have to offer. You're just like, it's not even worth it.
So I take it that the PTSD came in part from things that you witnessed while you were there.
Yeah, I have some pretty bad things. I watched two of my buddies actually get IED'd. They walked right up on an IED and just disappeared. They didn't die, which was amazing. I think I found my religion that day, but they didn't, not a scratch on them, but the people who we suspected as the trigger men of the IED were actually innocent. They didn't show any signs of any explosives on their hands or anything like that, but yet they were casualties themselves. We had one guy take a shot through the head, and then another guy get his Achilles heel blown off. And, you know, just sitting there listening to a guy moan, trying to keep him awake, you know, this stuff, it'll get to you. It'll get to you.
So, marital troubles, you lost some family members, PTSD, and you weren't getting the kind of support from the Army that you needed to help you deal with any of that. So, what did you do then?
I just started to think, you know, I had re-enlisted, actually. I re-enlisted for another 5 years because, like I said in the beginning, this is what I wanted to do. You know, they give you this idea they're going to take care of you and things are, it's one big family, you know. So, I was thinking to myself, I was just like, man, you know, I got to have a restart. I got to find a way to get myself out of this and start my life over, you know? I have nothing to work with. So I pretty much just started going through the things, you know, asking around, hey, what happened to this guy for doing this when he, you know, he'd get an Article 15. I was mainly not so worried about the disciplinary actions, but the discharge. That's what I was really worried about. I was asking around, and AWOL was one of the things. I heard a couple of things, but the one thing that came up to me was failing the urinalysis. I just couldn't fathom anybody you deploy with or anybody who says they care about you so much, like your battalion commanders do, would put you out with a bad discharge after you showing for 4 years all the honorable deeds you've done. So it seemed to me that was the best route for me. I wasn't so sure about AWOL. So I knew for a fact that if I failed a urinalysis, I would be able to get out, and I was pretty confident that I wouldn't get anything less than a general discharge.
And your concern about the type of discharge had to do with veterans' benefits?
That, and you know, how am I going to live the rest of my life? You know, how am I going to have a career? There was a lot of things going through my head, you know. And as a matter of fact, the very reason I was worried is actually what I'm doing now. You know, there's nothing. It's survival. I have no options, really.
So you made a decision to fail a urinalysis test, is that right?
When I went home on leave, I was just like, this is how I'm going to do it. Because as soon as you come back from leave, you know the very next day you're going to get a urinalysis test.
And that's what happened in your case?
Yes, sir.
And that was when?
That was in December of 06, or 05, I'm sorry.
So you failed the urinalysis test, and what happened next?
A couple of weeks went by, and then my platoon sergeant called me into the room. And he pretty much looked at me. I have nothing wrong with my platoon sergeant. He was a good guy. I've known him since basic training. And he ended up going to my battalion after he got done being a drill sergeant. So he knew me pretty well. And I had walked in there, and he was like, sure, you failed your analysis. And I was like, oh, yeah, I knew this was coming. And, of course, they put me in for my Article 15, and that was a little process. I did my 45 days of restriction and 45 days of extra duty. It wasn't a big surprise to get that. But then I had to go and stand in front of the battalion commander and have him read off my Article 15. He pretty much was just like, he read it all off, and he pretty much was just like, sure, you know, you can recover from this. And I looked right at him, and I was like, sir, I don't want to. I want out. And, you know, they were real polite about everything. They treated me like a family member until that point. When I said that, he just did a 180. He was just like, you don't deserve to be in the military. And that's when they proceeded to rip off my rank and go about doing the procedures of putting me out.
You got chaptered out. You didn't have a court-martial.
I passed up the court-martial.
And your discharge is a general discharge?
I got general under honorable conditions.
So does that allow you to remain eligible for medical benefits?
I don't know. I haven't even been to the VA yet. I've been nervous to go because I don't want to get pushed under a rug like I feel like I'm going to.
Now that you're out, are you doing anything for your PTSD?
Not really. I have been to a doctor. He gave me Lexapro for medications for that and medications for sleeping, but it doesn't help. I mean, what can I do? You know, I don't know what to do.
Are there any veterans around where you are, guys you can talk to who've gone through what you've gone through?
I've had some buddies I served with who I was up in Iraq with in my platoon come down and visit, and one of them had a friend that he was a lifelong friend with, and he was a veteran. And I finally, things are starting to chill out a little bit for me after 2 years of being out, but I finally, you know, he's a good person to talk to. I've pretty much just secluded myself from everything lately. I haven't even had any friends since I got out. I just, because when I talk to people, I'll be around family or friends, and they'll be talking, and I have nothing to say. You know, I feel like an idiot whipping out a war story because that's all I got, you know. So I just pretty much stick to myself until I got an opportunity to speak to a vet.
I'm sorry you're having such a tough time, William. It must be very hard for you. I hope you'll find a way to get some of the help you need. Now tell me, has all that you've gone through affected the way you feel about what the U.S. is doing militarily in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, I feel like they're exploiting those healthy young bucks that are just getting out of high school or going to be getting out of high school soon. You know, they're telling these guys all these things they want to hear about how glorious and how fun and how good the military is. Granted, there's some things that are good about it, but it's, you know, it's not going to last forever. It doesn't last forever. And when you do go in, everything changes. One thing I can tell you is they tell you, yeah, you could be, you know, you can end up in a war zone, okay? When you sign up, you know all this stuff. But what they don't tell you is you're going to be driving around, and you have rules on you that the people you're fighting don't use or go against. They don't use any of those rules. They don't abide by any rules. So you're pretty much a pawn. You do what they need you to do regardless how dangerous it is, you know. For instance, you're just driving up and down a road expecting to get blown up. We covered a good strip of highway. It was the most used transport highway in Iraq. It linked the north and south together. And that's where all of the supplies went up and down while we were there. Our job for about 2 weeks was to patrol that strip of highway and eliminate all threats of IEDs, whether that be they blow you up or you find them first. They just don't want IEDs there. You know, there's going to be they don't tell you that you're going to be the person that they pick to walk up to a suspected IED and give it a little nudge to see if it's a bomb, you know? They don't tell you these things. And these aren't things that these kids are thinking about. They don't know this stuff's there. They don't know it's like this. You know, they're thinking they're going to go in the Army, they're going to get taken care of, and they're going to get put into a huge combat situation when it's not. The only people that's getting to fire anything is the enemy.
So your sense is that the military is using young people for its own ends, but it's a war you don't approve of, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Well, William, we really appreciate your taking the time to tell Courage to Resist your story today. We wish you the very best of luck, and thank you so much for talking with us.
Something needs to be done, and I didn't know what I could do, and this is all I thought I could do.